I'm with two colleagues and friends who are really fierce feminist thinkers and scholars, and I'm really honored because we've been having a conversation through our work, but also personally for many years now. And so for me, this is a chance for us to just kind of talk out loud together, and I'm happy to invite you guys into the conversation. There is enough of us that we can really... I'm going to do this in stages. I'm going to help unpack maybe each of their books individually and then have a chance for us to talk together up here and then open it up to you. So it'll be like that, in the way that it goes on. And then I also want to really thank Ari and for opening the space to us, Anthony for putting together this event and so many others, also Joyce Moy, who's not able to be here tonight but heads the Institute and does a lot of amazing work and help bring these two speakers. And I hope, is that me? Is there something I should do? And then also Russell Leong, who is an editor for CUNY First and has been really seminal to my stay here. And then I especially want to thank Drs. Nadkarni and Rudrappa, is that how you pronounce it? Okay, just because I'm Indian doesn't mean I know. for taking time out of April, which is, I think, kind of the cruelest month of the semester in the academic year to have this conversation. So thank you both for coming. And as Anthony already said, but I'll give you maybe a couple more things about each of them. So I'm going to call you guys doctors just because we're doing this medical thing. Sure. And you are doctors, and so it all fits together. So, and my father would be happy to hear someone calling, you know, me a doctor. So Dr. Nadkarni is Associate Professor of English and Director of the Graduate Program in English at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We were colleagues there when I was at Amherst for a long time. Her research and teaching includes postcolonial literature and theory, transnational feminist theory, U.S. Empire Studies, and Asian American Studies, right, with an emphasis on the literatures and cultures of the South Asian diaspora. And so a lot of that comes out in her book because it's very interdisciplinary and crosses a lot of those fields. She's the author of Eugenic Feminism, Reproductive Nationalism in the United States and India, which was published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2014. And she's now at work on a second book project, tentatively titled From Opium to Outsourcing, which is a great title. And it focuses on, so keep that, that focuses on representations of South Asian labor in a global market. And so maybe we can hear more about that too towards the end. And then Dr. Rudrappa is a professor, like as Anthony said, a professor of sociology and director of the Center for Asian American Studies at UT Austin. So she's come a long way, geographically.
I have come a long way.
Otherwise, also. Her teaching and research interests relate to gender, race, and labor in the U.S. and India. And that's one of the things that ties a lot of our work together, right, is this kind of U.S. and India focus, but in a way that is about imperialism and... things that people might not necessarily come to their mind first. And her first book was Ethnic Roots to Becoming American, Indian Immigrants and the Cultures of Citizenship, which was published by Rutgers in 2004. And her book that we'll be speaking about tonight is, both of their book titles, Eugenic Feminism and Discounted Life, are really, fierce. Discounted Life, The Price of Global Surrogacy in India, which was published by NYU in 2015. And she's currently continuing her research, which she began in Discounted Life, in human material, specifically from women's bodies. And hopefully we can hear more about that as the talk goes on. So, like I said, Eugenic Feminism, Discounted Life. We're gonna one of the things, when I was thinking about how to put this together, there are several different ways in which these books and these works overlap. And one of them, in a way, is there's a continuity in time period covered, because... Dr. Nadkarni's book starts in, I think, in the late 19th century, mm-hmm. right, which is kind of the height of British Empire in the Indian subcontinent, and it goes through anti-colonial nationalism and then the post-colonial state up through the 1970s and ends with the emergency and under Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, right, 1975, 1977. And then Dr. Rudrappa's book, even though it's about mostly set in the 21st century and about surrogacy now, she traces it back to the emergency and Indira Gandhi and in 1975. So there's a kind of connection there. So I thought we would go through some of the basic themes and moments in eugenic feminism first, and then kind of go in using population control as our middle, go into Discounted Life, and then at the end talk more thematically. So I want to kind of, because I feel like a lot of this is territory. One of the things about doing both deep historical and transnational work is there's a lot of ground to cover. And so in part what I want to do in the beginning is just lay out some basic terms so that we can have a conversation. So, and either one of you can can interrupt and ask more while we're going. So, starting with eugenic feminism, in the very beginning, in your introduction, you bring up two women, Margaret Sanger and Dhanvati Ramarao. Mm-hmm. Is that how you pronounce them? Again, a South Indian woman, though.
Right, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about birth control, right? Yeah. So I want to start with birth control because I think that in kind of pop culture terms, birth control, even though it's in peril in some ways in the United States now, is also something that we think about in terms of liberation of of certain kinds of sexual acts from biological reproduction, right? And this kind of, so there's a deep ties between thinking of birth control and sort of feminist freedom, right? Mm-hmm. But the way that you start out your book complicates that history of birth control and gives us other ways of thinking about it and other histories that are associated with that, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of ask you about that history of birth control, why you start the book there.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And precisely one of the reasons is because it is this sort of symbol of kind of liberal feminist choice, but sort of to start with Margaret Sanger when she...
So everyone knows Margaret Sanger is. Yeah. Or was.
Right, yeah. And there's different kinds of arguments about, like, did she get in bed with eugenicists for expediency reasons? So she sort of started out, like, it would help working class women. A lot of people have done work on just kind of the evolution of her thought. And at some point, she does start doing these very eugenic arguments. I mean, actually, the quote, more from the fit, less from the unfit, when people heard that quote, is often associated with Margaret Sanger. I think it's actually, she was not the one who said it. Nonetheless, a lot of what she did do kind of ultimately was about less from the unfit, right? So only certain kinds of people should not be having babies. So I start the book with her speech that she's giving in Bombay, where she's talking about, you know, for the nation, for the newly independent nation, what we need are the right kind of people, right? So I'm kind of pointing to this positive, that's a sort of positive eugenic argument that she's putting forth. The future of the children are our future, kind of thing. And how at the same time, that kind of positive eugenics also gets folded into the next thing I talk about is Dhanvati Ramarao going into this slum in Bombay. And it's a sort of scene that in some ways is reminiscent of Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, mm-hmm. the sort of, you know, where he's going through, which opens, it's 1968, he's going through the streets of Delhi, I think. And he's like, there's people everywhere, you know, and this sort of sense of like just
it's a great start. You should read the opening. It's great drama.
Yeah, it's, you know.
People everywhere.
Yeah, I think he says that. I think that's like,
yes,
right. Like,
yeah.
He's just.
Yeah, so people defecating, people sweating, people.
Right.
Yes,
there's a fluvia. There are a lot of people. There's fluids.
Yes.
Yeah. So she does a kind of similar thing that she, and this is also kind of referencing this moment in national and sort of urban development where slums are starting. And so she goes and she says there's these children that are climbing all over, you know, piles of garbage and things. So she starts thinking, you know, instead of the children being like, on the one hand, there's this positive eugenics of the children are our future. On the other hand, there's this negative eugenics of, we don't really want those kinds of children. So I start with those figures to think about how these are both figures who are associated with advocating for birth control. Dhanvati Ramarao is sometimes called the Margaret Sanger of India. And together they actually, with another person, they founded International Planned Parenthood, which has also been involved with kind of population control in the third world. So I start there precisely to point out that while I would argue for reproductive justice and access to certain, you know, access to birth controls and things like that, if you look at this longer history, it's a compromised. The very people who have advocated for it have other times advocated for negative eugenic measures. And even the positive eugenic measures, I mean, they kind of can't separate the negative and the positive.
I was going to say, what's positive about, when you say, Margaret Sanger is positive eugenics, what does that mean?
Positive is the more from the fit, right? So positive eugenics is the right kind of people should have babies, and negative eugenics is the
the wrong people should not have babies.
So actually, and the eugenics movement in India was much more of a positive eugenics movement pre-independence. It was much more about right reproduction by the right class of people. And actually, it was very tied, though, into birth control. Whereas in the U.S., eugenics and birth control were kind of separate movements. So that's like one of the things. This is getting a little off topic, and I'll stop talking.
No.
One of the things I'm trying to trace in the book, too, is that eugenics as a global movement and as a transnational movement, but that was expressed very differently in different national sites based on many different local conditions. So I don't know if that.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. I wanted to just complicate birth control first and link it to what you were saying, like reproductive nationalism, right?
Right.
Which we started to talk about, but like among whom did, like what is reproductive nationalism in India? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Where did it come from? Who was advocating for it? And time period.
Okay. So, I mean, in the book, well, first of all, reproductive nationalism, just sort of using to talk about the idea that the way to make a stronger, better nation is going to be through various kinds of right reproduction
eugenics.
Positive eugenics. So basically, that's what I'm talking about. And in the book, I mean, you could probably trace it other places, but I look a lot at Sarojini Naidu. So this is, you know, kind of the run-up, early part of the 20th century run-up to independence. I mean, she was a poet, and most of her poetry was published sort of around the turn of the 20th century. And I look a little bit at that, but I sort of more look at her speeches. And so she's one of the people who are saying, kind of putting forward an idea of, we need to reproduce the nation properly for it to be an independent nation. And she's also making a really interesting argument about how, Indian women actually originated feminism. So she's doing a couple of moves that are really interesting. She's like, Western women think they're coming over here and bringing feminism, but we've always been feminist. So that's part of what she's doing, which I think is actually a really interesting thing. But then she goes back to these kind of reproductive arguments, right, to prove that. So even if we don't call ourselves feminists in the present day, if you go back, and she'll go back to kind of like, you know, largely, she does do some sort of Muslim, go back to Muslim things, but mostly like Vedic kind of, you know, look at these various women and,
Hindu.
Hindu, right. So that's one of the people, but there's a lot of, the other place, and then I'll just say this briefly, but the other place that I look, is there was a planning document, that was, I'm trying to remember the year of it, but it was pre-independence, but independence was on the horizon. And so there was a bunch of these different planning documents that kind of, much of which went into the five-year plans, except this one didn't and was kind of forgotten until it was found in the 70s by some feminist scholars. And it was the, I'm not going to remember the name of it, but it was basically, it was like how it was feminist planning for the nation, and it was looking at so some of the things were really great, like women should be paid for housework. So there's some really kind of radical things. But even in this document that was, you know, had these radical elements, it was very much the way that women are going to have proper rights within the state is by sort of the right kinds of reproduction and reproduction from the right people. And so there are. There's a different planning report on population that has explicitly eugenic things, but even this one that is sort of about gender equality, you know, in the independent nation, a lot of it is nonetheless centered in the idea that women's citizenship within the state should be sort of guaranteed by their ability to reproduce the nation. So that's part of the reproductive nationalism, too.
Yeah, I think what I really like about how you talk about that in the book is I want to bring this back to Mother India, the title of the kind of talk today. So a lot of the elite sort of feminist nationalists who are putting like Mother India as the kind of, you know, central figure for the new nation and therefore, you know, the rights-bearing figure in all these documents is someone who is a woman who has to biological woman, right, whose rights are given to her because she's the mother of the nation, like in a kind of biological way, right? So that's the kind of framework for rights, and it's also linked to these eugenic things where it's like she has to produce the right kind of women, have to produce the right kind of babies and all this, right? So there's positive eugenics. But Mother India has a history that's actually also in response to colonialism culturally, socially, politically, and economically in India under the British, but also points to the involvement of U.S. interests in India at the same time. And so to take a step back from these kind of, because you know, reproductive nationalism is really linked in your book to these kind of more elite anti-colonial nationalist Indian women, right? Most of whom are Hindu, most of whom are upper caste, and many of whom are posing like, we are the mothers of the nation, right? And so our rights come through us, right? But they are also, in some ways, in a conversation with, I mean, many things, but right, most famously in some ways, this book by U.S. journalist Catherine Mayo called Mother India, right? And so can you talk about, like, what that book was? Because it's produced also in the early 20th century. In fact, Sarojini Naidu, who she mentioned, who's like a Gandhian kind of, you know, figure, came to the U.S. on a tour in response to Mother India, this book by the journalist. So can you talk a little bit about that book and then how it relates to reproductive nationalism and to eugenic feminism?
Yes, and like, and it's funny. I mean, I know that you write about Sarojini Naidu's tour post.
Both that and Mother India,
And Mother India. I know that you write about that too. But that she sort of says, and she doesn't actually address the book. She just says, I am embodying Mother India. and so I will just sort of prove my superiority. But so anyways, but to say what Mother India is, so in 1927, Catherine Mayo, kind of a muckraking journalist who had written screeds, I think you could say that, on the Philippines, and other, she had taken up various different sort of social issues. So she decides she's going to write this book on India, and her aim was really to support British imperialism in India. So she had written this book called Isles of Fear. So that kind of gives you an idea about the Philippines, and it was very much again in support. Sort of look at all of these horrible practices of these people, particularly around public health. So that was kind of her thing. She paints the Philippines as this kind of public health problem that thus requires U.S. imperialism to sort of remain in place because obviously, you know, these people can't manage themselves. So she sort of thinks, great, I'll do the same thing for India. And in fact, I think the Rockefeller Foundation, I mean, is
supposedly funded her work, but they're the major funders of public health at this time, everywhere.
And so she originally is going to do a book about public health, and a lot of Mother India is about public health, but what she really decides to seize on is taking this figure of Mother India and really perverting it. So this is already this very strong nationalist symbol, and she said, well, I'm going to focus on the actual mothers. And so she focuses, on, among other things, on child marriage and basically childbirth practices. And so the titular chapter, Mother India, is this really pretty horrific description of a woman giving birth, and it's with, you know, using a native midwife, a dye, and it's all about her, you know, dirty hand, you know, so it's all of the stuff around how unhygienic these childbirth practices is. But then it's also sort of spins out from that and just look generally degenerate sex practices in India generally, right? And so she's using all of this to say, really, British imperialism two things need to happen. British imperialism needs to stay in place because, again, these people can't manage themselves, and also that there should be no immigration. She's also kind of arguing, I mean, at this point, there was not, right? This was after 1924. So there wasn't South Asian immigration to the U.S., but there was a bill that was, I think, the same year that Mother India came out, the Copeland bill, that was about, that was an argument to naturalize South Asians as U.S. citizens who are already here, right? So she just was really, but arguing, this is, you know, this is a worldwide menace, and it's a sexual menace, and it's a public health menace. So that was maybe more about Mother India. But that becomes this really important flashpoint moment in the relationship between the India and the U.S. Many, many books are written in response, refuting it on the level of fact, but also sort of saying, also for kind of the symbolic work she's doing by, you know, saying, Mother India, you have this glorious idea, but look, I'm going to show you these degenerate kind of mothers and degenerate sex practices, and you say you revere the mother, but look at how she's reviled. So I don't know if that's kind of, but so really what she's doing there is this perversion of nationalist kind of reproductive nationalism that's been in place, right? And then Sarojini Naidu comes to the U.S. and says, she doesn't actually address the book, right? She just sort of says, through my superior being, I will embody Mother India and show the true Mother India. But it was a very controversial
Yeah, there's like a famous Indian movie or Bollywood movie that was made like called Mother India. But, you know, for me, the interesting thing that you do with this is this Mother India is really a way to think about how the U.S. was involved in British imperialism on the Indian subcontinent, right? Because these forces, not just ideologically, you know, with Catherine Mayo and her book and all the images and all the responses, but also the fact that public health becomes this very specific vector that that U.S. forces use to enter into. I mean, you know, it's the way they talk about the Philippines, which of course was a U.S. colony at the time, but the fact that they are bringing, they meaning the Rockefeller Foundation, actually brings public health work to the U.S. South, to the Caribbean, to South America, also to India, also to other places. And so Mayo is part of that spread. And I think a lot of times in our conceptions of the history of capitalist imperialism and U.S. imperialism, we don't think of India because it's so strongly identified with British imperialism. But here we have, and the through line through all, like all of our work, but also through a lot of the connections between imperialism, capitalism, India and the United States, India, South Asia, but also India specifically, actually, is medicine, right? And one of the places that this starts is actually in the public health work that's done in the name of imperialism, right, under the British, but through U.S. forces in South Asia, right?
And so, and just sort of to think through, and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation occupies a very similar sort
it's
of role.
It's still, absolutely. It's like very, like when you look back at the Rockefellers and look forward, like now at Bill and Melinda Gates, it's kind of the same thing, but a different, under a different form of capitalism, so it functions.
And new ways of organizing how health will be delivered.
Sure. And, yes, and always around women and reproduction.
Right.
Before Catherine May and Rockefeller were the missionaries, right, many of whom were women, and also focused on childbirth as the site of intervention. So there's a really long history. So, and then the other really important thing that Dr. Ned Carney, I keep wanting to call you Asha, does in her work is this connection that you made between her anti-immigration, Catherine Mayo's anti-immigration policies, and her policies around continuing colonialism in South Asia. So there's, for her, in her mind, there's a very clear link, and it also, even though it was 1917 is when the Asiatic Bar Zone was passed, and South Asians had been excluded, and so it's part of that anti-Asian rhetoric that had already been built up in the United States around keeping Asians out, but also specifically in that time, Indians or Hindus, who were called Hindus, universally.
And because there's also a kind of cultural fascination that she's writing against in that moment too, this so-called Hindu craze where people are
Swamis and Deepak Chopra. And
like
yoga.
I mean, it's a similar moment we can recognize, but it happened in the late 20s. So she says, you know, and she sort of figures this as a form of sexual seduction that white American women are particularly susceptible to and should ward against.
So I want to be mindful of time because I know I want to get to everything. There's two more things I want to do with you before we before we move on, which is I want to talk about. So we go from reproductive nationalism, like Mother India, which is this colonial, really gives a sense of the colonial world, and then reproductive nationalism, which is a kind of elite, I want to stress this, kind of an elite elite feminism within India, right? Because, for example, that scene in Mother India with the dye, it's never oppressed caste or class women who are supposed to be reproducing, and they are also the problem to in the reproduction of privileged caste and class women. So there's this very much, and I hope we can talk about that more in the end. But then we have, how does reproductive nationalism turn into population development, and how does population development turn into population control? So this is kind of entering into the post-colonial state.
Okay, I'm going to try to be more succinct.
You don't have to be succinct.
There are so many pieces that... Well, I feel like, so one thing to think about in eugenics in India, pre-independence, it is more about positive eugenics, access to birth control, but it wasn't necessarily about... wasn't population control. It actually starts looking much more like U.S. eugenics pre-World War II in the post independence period. And so part of what I'm trying to argue in the book is precisely through the regime of development that particularly modernization theory, which is though not all development in India was U.S.-led, modernization theory as a theory was something that was modeled on the U.S., right? So, and part of how, what happens is this idea of, like, what does it mean to be modern? To be modern means to have a certain kind of family. It means to have a certain number of children, less. So at first it sort of seems like, well, if we develop the rhetoric, if you look at the five-year plans, it's like what we need to do is just develop. Women will become more educated. Population will drop. And then at some point, it's demographic transition theory, I think, and then at some point the idea, they say, well, what if we just reverse the logic? Let's take care of population, and then that will, modernization will happen. And so this is the moment really where kind of massive population control policies start. And, I mean, and they're also very much, they are an articulation on the national level of national policy, but they're also very much pressured and directed by this global sense that, you know, we're living in an overpopulated world. I mean, the Ehrlich moment is a little bit later.
The population bomb is
60s, yeah. But it is interesting, actually, even those first couple of five-year plans, it takes a little while even for India to sort of really go to the population control moment. The first couple of, you know, they're still sort of thinking, let's work on these other things. And of course, access to birth control was kind of tricky. Like, Gandhi was not for birth control, sort of. So there was different.
Or he actually wants to do sort of the rhythm method of birth control, right? He doesn't want medicalization.
Organic. Exactly.
Well, it's also a kind of stance against medicalization he has anxieties about, and
But there was also specifically funding was tied to population control, right? From global sources,
exactly.
Especially the U.S. Johnson.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Like you will not get food aid unless you take care of this population problem. So, So it wasn't even, so I'm saying that there was sort of like the national articulation, the global, and not just pressure, like rhetorically speaking, but like, yes, development funds being tied to the population problem. So that's part of how, like Margaret Sanger's kind of the children are our future vision that I start the book with turns into, we just need less children. Which is,
and specifically from certain kinds of people, right?
Yes.
And so then, like, you know, I guess just to fast forward a little bit, so then we get to the kind of apex of this, right, which to many people is seen. And it's funny when you think about it in the long run that all of it gets blamed on Indira Gandhi in the sense that, I mean, obviously she was prime minister when the emergency happened.
Right.
And there are mass sterilization campaigns, right, which I want to ask you about. But it has such a long history that you can't just put it on, you know, it's
the camp architecture.
So do you want to talk a little bit about the emergency or
talk about the emergency? You know what,
maybe we can say what the emergency was because maybe not everybody knows.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So,
because there are a lot of emergencies.
The emergency 1975 to 1977, if I'm missing key pieces of this, so Indira Gandhi's prime minister, the issue was around an election.
It was around the budget.
The budget, okay.
Yeah. And there's a massive budget crisis with inflation and such. And there's also quite a few political challenges to her controlling to the Congress party. And then there's massive organizing, which is really quite left-leaning that emerges.
Right. Yeah. And in response, she declares a state of emergency,
She suspends the Constitution.
Right.
Yeah.
Basic civil liberties. But then the other thing, and it was under, largely under the behest of Sanjay Gandhi, right?
And she's complicit.
But he was, you know, sort of, there were mass sterilization camps. And, you know, already there had been kind of sterilization tied to incentives and disincentives, so you get things if you get sterilized, you lose your job if you don't. You know, like these kinds of very coercive measures had already been in place, but then this happens on a very large scale. And so,
you know, I think what also happens is especially Muslim men are being targeted for sterilization, and it's forced sterilization, where they're being rounded up and being sent into camps, and vasectomies are being performed. And I think the sterilization rates are massive during the emergency years. And what is interesting is women are also being sterilized, but that doesn't get politicized as much as
male sterilization.
That was very, I mean, not to swerve to
your
book,
but this is the time when we're doing that.
Right, okay, that's what we're doing now. That because my book sort of stops in the emergency, that you sort of say, but after that, actually, women become. So I sort of think about how men were, right, but which is really interesting, which I want to ask you about. And then the only other thing I would say about the emergency, too, is thinking about the theme of Mother India is the way that Indira Gandhi, even as she's doing all of these things, you know, sort of that she's also trying to kind of project herself as this mother, as Mother India. Like, that's one of the sort of symbolic things that she's drawing upon. So that's all. Yeah.
And we'll get back to more that's in your work, but we'll make the switch now.
That's
so great. So 1975, a lot of all the surrogacy that you're talking about is happening in the 21st century.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so how do you see, or, you know, why do you go back to this period in your work or your thinking around surrogacy?
Well, let me preface a little my work.
Yeah, yeah, itself. Sure. Mm-hmm.
I've never quite been interested in reproduction. It just wasn't that interesting. I really am a sociologist of labor. Mm-hmm. And at some level, when I started thinking about surrogacy, it was really thinking about, you know, care work and the continuum, thinking about nursing, right? Thinking about Linter's work with domestic workers or Erica Grajeda's work on domesticas, right? Is really thinking at some level about surrogacy as a labor form and the care continuum, which was what at some level motivated me to think about surrogacy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, how can you not think about reproduction? Because it is reproduction. It is women's bodies, right? So I started thinking through, really at some level, surrogacy. So much of surrogacy in India is organized, not perhaps in Bombay, but certainly in Delhi, well, lesser so in Delhi, but in the south, but also in Gujarat. It's organized in dormitories where surrogate mothers are kept in dorms, right? Which is very similar to the kind of camp architecture you would see in sterilization camps. But also what was interesting is the various doctors, well, one doctor in particular, this fabulous, fabulous woman, Sulochana Gunashila, Dr. Sulo, you know, she passed away in 2012. And she would always tell me, I would say, Sulo, why are you doing surrogacy? What leads you to do this? And she would say, look, when in the 70s and 80s, I used to participate in these camps doing sterilization of women, right? So about 25 to 100 women from villages would be bused into a small local town. A school or a public hospital, if a public hospital was not available, it's a public school. They would use generators. Women would be then serially sterilized, right? And Sulo had actually been trained in Johns Hopkins.
Mm-hmm. Which was funded by the
Rockefellers, right?
A lot of my work is on Rockefellers.
Yeah. So there's all these connections we start seeing with the Rockefellers. Very interesting. So Sulo actually learns how to do laparoscopic surgery, and it's part of a development project that she takes part in, goes back. And she would say, Sharmila, I knew how to sterilize women. And then women would come to me and say, you know how to stop me from having children, but what about those of us who don't have children? And she said, as a feminist, you know, it was my duty to work on this. I mean, she's lovely. But also the other interesting thing for me was almost all of the surrogate mothers I interviewed, and I talked with 70 surrogate mothers in Bangalore, right, had opted for permanent sterilization as a form of birth control. So they'd all had the fallopian tubes snipped or blocked or what have you, right? And so it was very interesting because it hadn't sort of occurred to me when I was doing field work. It's only when I started writing, I was like, there's this constant going back to sterilization and female sterilization. And you might wonder, how do they become surrogate mothers then if they're sterilized, right? Because what you do with sterilization is you clip or block the fallopian tube so the eggs can't travel to the uterus. But you don't need the surrogate mother's eggs, right? So you prepare an embryo belonging to the clients who may have purchased the egg, sperm, what have you, in a petri dish. And then when they call them embryos, they're really at the blastocyst stage. You prepare the surrogate mother's body for a pregnancy and you implant the embryo, usually 4 embryos per woman, so that she can carry them to term. And then you selectively reduce to optimal birth rates per woman, right? So it was impossible not to talk about birth control. Mm-hmm. And it was also interesting because I remember doing these interviews and one of the surrogate mothers looks at me and says, you know, because they would look at my phone, which has pictures of my children, and the second one was is a boy. Right? Was actually, one can never say because he gender bends like crazy. But anyway, you know, I think he identifies as a boy now. Anyway, they're looking at these pictures and then they would hear this is a boy and they'd say, so have you had the operation? And I was like, no. And they thought I was a savage. They was like, you don't practice birth control? Why? There's other forms. Women in America don't do birth control. Why? It's like, there's really other forms. And it was sort of interesting to me that sterilization was the form of birth control available to working class women. Mm-hmm. Right? So there was no way I could avoid,
that.
Talking about sterilization.
Mm-hmm. And starting there. And then can you just, you've already done it a little bit, but can you draw us a map of the world through surrogacy? Like how, you know, the, you know, starting with, let's say, the eggs and the sperm and then just the process. I mean, just a sketch of the process, because that, you know, that will help draw a map of who and what we're talking about.
Yeah. And maybe I can talk a little bit about what happens after my book, because surrogacy gets banned in India, commercial surrogacy
we'll do
in 2016.
That. Yeah.
But I'm going to do that in terms of mapping what's going on.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. So, surrogacy really emerges from the so-called test tube baby that emerges in 1977, England, right, where you start realizing that you can actually get sperm, you can get eggs, you can prepare it in a petri dish, and then implant it into a womb that you have prepared, right? And this is actually done with a heterosexual couple, you know, Louise Brown is born, and so on and so forth. It's 1977. That process within 10 years very quickly gets commercialized in the U.S. And, of course, people have heard of the Baby M case, right, where you're using and this upper middle class couple recruits a working class woman to carry a fetus to term for them. Husband's sperm, eggs have been purchased through egg banks, prepared in a petri dish and introduced to this woman's body so she can give birth. Very quickly what happens is you realize that you don't need to restrict this within a single nation state. And this especially happens, it's happened in the U.S. U.S. actually is one of the leading providers of surrogacy services, right? But by 2002, India legalizes commercial surrogacy. Thailand, a few years later, also legalizes commercial surrogacy. What do I mean by commercial surrogacy? Money is going to be exchanged. It's not altruistic where a woman is going to say, let me have a baby for you, Sujani. Right? It's not that, right?
Right.
Instead, it's like, let me have a baby for you and give me a month, right? That's commercial surrogacy. It's a wage kind of a relationship. So India and Thailand emerge. They're going to be producing surrogacy services for you for anywhere between $35,000 to $60,000 for a singleton baby. If it's twins, then it's a bit more. They will guarantee you a pregnancy because they're going to recruit multiple women for each couple, two women actually. They will introduce four embryos per woman and then selectively reduce so you have the optimal chance of walking away with the baby, right? If there is no success, then they will not return. I mean, they will, you know, they will see to it that you get a success, right? It's not as if they're going to keep charging you more and more. In the U.S., it can be anywhere from $80,000 to $180,000, right? So it becomes like the more economic option to go to these countries. But this is where it starts to get interesting is embryos can be sent straight from the U.S. or you can and then there's anxieties around shipping embryos. But you can send frozen sperm from anywhere or frozen eggs. So you start seeing newspaper ads, especially in college newspapers, which are infamous for egg donation in the U.S. You target college students, college newspapers, to recruit egg donors, and you recruit military wives for surrogate mothers, you target very different populations, right? Because genetics ostensibly matters. It actually doesn't. It's kind of a crapshoot, how we emerge. So you also start seeing ads in U.S. college newspapers saying, go spend 2 weeks in Bombay, and while you're there, you can drop a few eggs and, have, all... Sure, we arranged this fabulous trip for you, but you also can make some money, right? You start seeing ads like that. There's also enough of an underclass in white underclass in South Africa. So South Africa becomes a source as well for eggs. So
because people want white babies.
Because people want white babies, right? But also many of the intended parents I interviewed, client parents I call them, actually used Indian egg donors. So in India, the market works quite differently. Say I'm a working class woman. I can sell my eggs even though I'm sterilized. How do they do that? Stimulate the body with hormones, and then once you keep testing the body to see whether the eggs have matured, you use laparoscopic surgery and pick about 15 to 30 eggs. Right? You don't need the fallopian tube. You don't want it to go anywhere because you actually don't want it to go anywhere. Get it? All right. And then those eggs will be sold to clients. But also now this woman who sold her eggs can work as a surrogate mother for a different couple because eggs and wombs have been disconnected, right? And so many of the surrogate mothers I worked with had actually also been egg donors. But the reason they don't use the same woman and womb and the same eggs from the woman is you really want to, at some level, splinter all of it so legal rights are massively splintered as well, so that the clients then have optimal rights over the baby because they've purchased this and legally they're the owners of the egg and sperm. So, oh, and what happens is India banned surrogacy in 2012 for queer couples. And then the ban is extended to all commercial surrogacy in 2016, which has interesting repercussions. But even though my fieldwork had ended, I'd gotten to go and hang out with certain interesting people. When gay couples are banned from going to India in 2012... what doctors start doing in Delhi is they're recruiting Indian surrogate mothers, implanting them with embryos that belong to gay couples because they've frozen those embryos in Delhi, sending the women to Nepal to give birth to the babies, and the clients will go pick up the babies, right? And then the earthquake happens, which then, stops the whole trade. But also I met this guy in Bombay. So I think Bombay and also he being, having these ties to Gujarat, he has old family connections to East Africa. And so he recruits his surrogate mothers from Kenya. And women are brought in, implanted with embryos belonging to gay couples from Spain, England, Australia, Israel, the U.S., where have you, right? Keeping the women in Bombay for 24 weeks and then sending them back. So literally then women become like shipping containers carrying cargo across these countries. And that's when I realized I'm done with this research. I'm not going to do this because it's grotesque. And I can't.
And we'll get back to that in a second. But first, I wanted to, just to bring it back to Mother India, actually, right? Because India, at least at the time of your research, was the major place in the world for surrogacy, and it had been the United States before.
Yes.
So I feel like we've already sort of answered this question, but I want, if either of you have comments on it, how did India become the sort of primary place? And I feel like in some ways it's related to population control.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, there's two things that are going on here. I mean, actually, some of the surrogacy agencies call India mother destination, right? India is mother destination. Forget Mother India, because you don't want these Indian women to become mothers.
right?
And they actually
for other people to become mothers.
Yeah. And there's actually a lot of arguments and pushback I get when I talk about surrogate mothers by various people who engage in these practices, because they say they're surrogates, they're not mothers.
Right.
And actually the term that is used...
You can take the word mother out.
Yes. And the term that is used in the U.S. today is gestational carrier. So sometimes I do this talk and they say, why don't you call them gestational carrier? And I turn around and say, why do you call them gestational carrier? Let's think through this. Right? So the... It is not that they want these women to be mothers. That is most emphatically not an interest at all. It's mother destination. So those very bodies that are overly fecund, that are actually wasteful because they're producing so much, and this is like overproduction of stuff you don't want, right?
The wrong kind of babies.
The wrong kind of babies. Literally stuff you don't want, right? Is now going to be harnessed for producing babies you want. And that there's actually foreign exchange, there's actually, you know, capital that is being earned. And this is seen as this great employment opportunity where women can pull themselves up by the uteri.
Right. Which you use. But I mean, and that leads directly to my next question, which is that, you know, in the beginning of your book, you talk about the stereotype of people imagining, like, who were the women in India who would become surrogates? And that they would be from the most downtrodden or oppressed groups, but you actually found something slightly different, right? So who are the where did the surrogates come from?
At least in the case with Bangalore, and I don't know how it plays out in different parts of India. Bangalore has a very robust garment industry. In other parts of India, it might be textiles, but in Bangalore and also in Chennai, the south, the garment industry is much more robust. And it's sort of interesting to think about garment industry and the globalization of garment production, because I think this is how also India becomes the site for IT workers. Bangalore, sorry, becomes a site for IT work. Is the first thing that gets globalized is garments. You learn how to do it. Anyway, that's another story. Working in the garment industry is such that so much of the work on the shop floor is driven by global demand in garments and fashion styles and so on and so forth. So labor on the garment factories actually makes the women disposable workers in the sense that when you need, I don't know, 5,000 t-shirts produced within 2 weeks, right? The women are being worked like crazy, and you're also recruiting new workers. But once you don't get that contract is done, and if the factory owner is unable to get a new contract in time, workers have a ton of time. And these cycles are incredibly exhausting for women. And they actually, and again, I would love to say that I made this, you know, connection, but actually it was the surrogate mothers who would always say, compared to garment work, this is fabulous, right? And so most of the recruiting of surrogate mothers was actually happening in garment factories. Garment sweatshops. There we go.
Yeah.
Right?
Where there was, you know, a lot of sexual harassment. Because I feel like there's a lot of morality around sex and sex work and care work and all of this. So that was interesting to me.
Yes. What is happening with garment sweatshops is, if anyone who's actually studied, you know, maquiladoras where they're producing garments, is that one of the chief ways by which you extract labor from women and speed up the assembly line is sexually harassing women, especially when it's all women workforces, as garment industry tends to be, right? So there's all kinds of sexual innuendos, grabbing, touching, to physical threats of rape and such, that the women are under tremendous pressure then to produce more because it's, well, who wants to be sexually harassed, right? And so the women would say, actually, you know, that kind of work is incredibly degrading. And to become a surrogate mother, I actually became a surrogate mother not by having sex with anyone, right? It was medically done. And here I am in this woman-only space. I don't need to get up at 5 o'clock to cook for my kids, get them to school. I don't need to go to work. I can lie in bed and someone is going to serve me food. When else am I going to have this kind of time, right? So it was incredible to me that something that I was imagining and is at ethical, moral level, you know, deepened commodification of the body, women were actually seeing it as far less degrading than garment work.
Mm-hmm. Or housework, right?
For their own families, because right. It's exhausting, right? And what was then also interesting is that it wasn't as if they didn't see this as exploitation, because it is exploitation, right? But then they would also ask, so you think you're not exploited?
Yeah, sweetie? No, right.
But it's the kind of work and sort of the deep bodily sort of...
Which I think brings out all this moral stuff. And so I wanted to ask you two things, and they're probably related. Because my first question was actually about getting us a picture of the client, also the client parents, because now they've given us a picture of who the surrogate mothers are. But also
Can I actually, one question? I didn't say why they were not the poorest of the poor.
Oh, right.
Sorry.
Oh, right.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I apologize.
No, it's okay.
I just remembered. If a woman is incredibly impoverished, she's not going to have the bodily structure and the physical comportment that makes her a desirable recruitee for surrogacy. Are her teeth all intact and she have a nice smile, right? Is her hair neat? Is the sari all right? Does it look like she has running water in the house or at least access to a tap where she has fresh water? Does it look like she might have family members and such who can take care of her children when she comes to the dormitory, right? If she is the poorest of the poor, she's simply not going to be recruited.
Right.
So these are sort of the working, you could call them working class. So what was interesting as I started, disentangling this argument is it's precisely because these women engage in this sort of labor that they're seen as horrible women. Mm-hmm. Right? They might talk about this as, oh, this was a gift greater than life these women gave me. But the fact, what kind of a woman is this, right, who could get pregnant and she never felt any attachment to this baby that she could give it away just for $4,000, right? And so these women then start getting posited as these really suspect characters by the intended parents. And so they would say, this is how the market protects us. She may have given me a gift greater than life, but it's not a gift relationship. It's a commodity relationship. I have no interest because this is this dangerous suspect creature who's going to keep making demands on me and my family, and the market protects me.
Right, and that goes right into the question about the moral economy of that map that you're talking about, and how. So you already sort of said it, but I don't know if you want to say any more about how surrogate mothers understand their relationship, how client parents do, and how the recruiters and medical people do.
Yeah.
All the intermediaries.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's the relationship between the commodity and gift and moral and this, which is really in your analysis a lot.
I think one of the things that I'm marking, and it's sort of an old anthropological argument about gift and commodity, right? A gift or a commodity basically circulate in society. But how they differ is the kinds of social relations that go about making the gift what it is, right? A gift relationship or a gift is given between people who have an ongoing social relationship. Doesn't mean it's egalitarian. It almost always never is, right? But at least there's this fraught, hierarchical, constant engagement that's going on between people who are giving gifts to each other, right? Whereas a commodity, on the other hand, is like when I buy a car. I pay for the car, it becomes mine. I don't think about all of the labor that's gone into it to actually making it what it is. Who did what, right? So a commodity at some level is a much more of a, relationship that
transactional.
It's transactional. It's atomized, right? There's not an ongoing social relationship.
Right.
Yeah, it's alienation,
right?
And so it was interesting for me that this intended parents, who actually kept talking about this as this amazing gift of life I received, actually were most invested in a commodity relationship. Whereas the surrogate mothers is like, I need this money, this is great work. We're actually interested in maintaining more of a gift-like relationship. Mm-hmm. Not because they absolutely loved it, but loved the baby. That they did. Some of them genuinely did, right? Many of them genuinely did. But also, a gift relationship would mean, in a place like Bangalore, $4,000 is nothing. It's gone in 2 months, right? And so if you really want to help the poor, the point is to build social networks that they can constantly call upon for loans, for jobs, for letters of recommendation, what have you. Right?
And that's what's cut off by the commodity relationship.
That is what is cut off, and that is what the women hoped to actually access, the surrogate mothers.
Right. Right.
And I get implicated in this as well, because as a researcher,
I
become that node. Mm-hmm. Who's also one of the networks for the women.
Can I ask just a question? Because and I believe it's in your conclusion that you talk about how some surrogates want to get together and do a co-op.
Yes.
And that this is, the clients
are not into that.
Are not into that idea. where they would get to live in their, they would not have to live in a dormitory, they get to live in their own home.
It's really interesting because I've finished field work, at least I think I've gotten enough because the stories, there's saturation point to the stories. And some of the surrogate mothers that I know invite me and say, come on over for lunch, we'll cook a meal and we'll sit and chat. And so there we are, this is January 2012, I'm done with field work. And then they say, we would like to start a surrogacy cooperative. And so by that, we will, undergo all of the medical treatment, but we don't want to stay in dormitories. We want to stay at home. We will take ourselves to doctors, appointments, so on and so forth. But we want more control, and we don't want these middle persons messing with our lives. Can you be a broker for us? Can you please bring clients? My brokerage services are really lame. I'm sorry. I can't bring you clients. But let me ask around, right? And so I actually talk with some of the agents who take clients to India, and I ask one of them, saying, would you be interested in actually taking your clients to these people? I can introduce you and, step away. And she basically says, no. Because how are we going to trust these women? They're not in dormitories. How do we trust them? And these are our babies. How are we going to trust these women? This would simply not fly.
So, and just actually to go back to your work for a second, mm-hmm. because when you're outlining reproductive nationalism, we tried to emphasize a little bit that it was led by these more elite
yes.
women.
Mm-hmm.
So were there responses? Were there other... this is another response, right, mm-hmm. to the medical industrial mm-hmm. complex and mm-hmm. how it's channeling surrogacy. Mm-hmm. Did you find in your research other responses from different sectors of society?
I mean, certainly, yes. I think that yes, the answer is yes. And it's funny because the whole concept of eugenic feminism, I'm sort of talking about as this very hegemonic feminist, nationalist feminist. So in some ways, I don't end up telling the story of, either in the United States. There's a lot of work done by feminists of color on eugenics, on how, and in sort of movements against eugenics by women of color. And similarly in India, not everyone bought into this reproductive nationalism. And so I have a chapter, I can't remember what chapter, that sort of is talking about the 1950s and this sort of narrative of where does feminism go, which it doesn't disappear. But one of the things that I don't get into there, but that a lot of radical feminist energy that had been kind of channeled towards independence goes into sort of Marxist causes and other kinds of, other anti-state kind of things that are interesting, but I don't talk about them necessarily, but they are there. And I just wanted, I do end with surrogacy little bit to sort of think about, and again, I end kind of right at the moment of neoliberalism, and then the epilogue just sort of takes it up and sort of think about what's the neoliberal mother India. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different kind of treatment of it because I'm really just looking at a documentary film called Google Baby, so it's mm-hmm. not this sort of deep, textured work on transnational surrogacy, but it's really like how is it being represented in this HBO documentary. And it's interesting because the clients aren't figured at all. And it's all about kind of the egg donor, who is this U.S. woman, and she's very much individuated. And then there's the surrogate, the gestational, the surrogates in India, who are all kind of interchangeable. There's a couple that are a little more individuated. But it's interesting that in this moment, like part of what I'm trying to say with the the neoliberal mother India is that if eugenic feminism as this formation that I'm trying to examine in the U.S. and India, and that could you could take that. It's meant to be a framework that could be looked at, and it would look different in different national contexts, but that it's there, I would argue. But really, that's all about the state. And so what happens in this kind of neoliberal moment when Mother India is not really in service of the state so much as transnational, the market. So that's kind of where I end. And that doesn't really necessarily
answer your question. No, it does. I mean, and to go back to the market, there are two more questions I have for you, and then I have that question about slavery that I want to ask.
Oh, gosh.
But
that's a good question.
One is just choice, the role of choice in your ethnographic research. Like, how do people frame choice in their lives, and how does that relate to this kind of precarious neoliberal climate?
Yeah.
And also, how does it relate to actual ways in which people try to retain humanity at the same time? Like, what's the tension there?
I tend not to talk about choice because I think that's one of the most politically retrograde concept you can have, because we don't quite think through the conditions under which choice emerges.
Right.
And so, especially when I think about surrogacy, a lot of the clients would say, you know, if you're pro-choice, why are you against these surrogate mothers being surrogate mothers? It's her body, it's her choice, isn't it? No one's coercing her, right? And it just becomes very empty.
Yes.
So I really want to start thinking really not even about reproductive rights, because against rights talk is so individualized.
Right.
Because I'm going to talk about the surrogate mother's rights versus gay man's rights. I mean, it's just so fragmented and problematic. I think reproductive justice makes more sense, as Asha, you were saying earlier. And really think through the conditions under which certain kinds of choices become available.
Right.
And I'm much more interested in those kinds of ethics.
So more social and political analysis.
Yes.
And then I just wanted to discounted life, the title, right?
Yes.
Which is actually a great play on words. But whose lives are being discounted?
It's the surrogate mothers.
Right. I just wanted everyone.
Yeah. No, because people kind of think, oh, the babies are a discount.
They are discounted. The babies are discounted.
Yes.
Right. But that's the price.
The price. But it's really the women's labor, the ways by which they're not just physical, affective, you know, the kinds of roles they could play in these nuclear families where there's babies. I mean, it's discounting on so many different
levels. So I don't know if you guys want to ask each other more questions, or I want to ask this one question about something that was haunting me when I was reading both of your books. It's a little bit difficult and tricky, especially given the moral economy of some of the things you're talking about, because you're doing an ethnography. But especially when I was reading Discounted Life, but also thinking about eugenics, and because I'm a scholar of American studies and have done a lot of sort of work coming out of the Black radical tradition, I could not help but think that in some ways there's nothing new about life as a commodity when you think about the history of enslavement, right? And so, you know, Black women's relationship to childbearing is very much, you know, there's an echo, a very distinct echo, although it's not the same thing, right, for many different reasons. And so I think about surrogacy and slavery, right? And then I also think about eugenics, obviously, and slavery, because of the close and constitutive relationships that eugenics has to that project and to scientific racism and all that kind of stuff. So I just wonder if we could talk a little bit about how we would think about Blackness, slavery, and all this in relation to these topics that are tying the U.S. and India together, right? So are tying sort of, and in many ways, U.S. imperialism begins with indigenous peoples and with enslaved peoples, right? So I want to open that up.
Do you want to go?
Well, I'm going to approach this question through Charlotte Perkins Gilman, the subject of my first chapter, but I say that kind of facetiously. But I mean, I think that, yes, obviously the history of eugenics is very much, in the U.S., is very much about targeting immigrants and African American children. And so one of the things that, but when thinking about and just Black reproduction generally, right, this is one of the, and again, so when I was sort of referencing, there's, you know, a lot of really good feminist work on that, right? But why I'm thinking of Gilman too, and sort of thinking about slavery, so part of how I started thinking about the whole framework of eugenic feminism was through Gilman and sort of through these utopian, her utopian novels and these utopian futures that she imagines. And part of it was also about this sort of her, the racial schema within which she's placing these ideas. And so it's interesting for her, and this is also sort of part of kind of turn of the 20th century, just kind of scientific racist thought, right? You have, Asia, these are degenerate sort of societies that have had great pasts but have fallen. Africa, as a continent, African Americans are underdeveloped but can develop, right? So she had all of these crazy, so these kinds of schemes are animated in her utopians, and of course all of these people then ultimately are excised, but they kind of both sort of Asians and Africans appear at these moments to sort of signify these different, you know, these sort of different sort of racial schemes. So that doesn't necessarily get, and she also had this idea that really what we needed to do was to actually just put all African Americans into like labor camps, which kind of sounds to me just like slavery, that, you know, because until they're properly developed. So I think that
which
that's the
sounds,
other.
Which also
sounds exactly like slavery. That is my point there. But so I think that there's a way of thinking about, I mean, and this is maybe just thinking about like the intellectual project that I was going on in this book of how this kind of civilizational racial scheme gets tied into ideas of development that are also ideas about reproduction, which, so that doesn't necessarily get to the question about slavery and
right.
how.
I mean, in some ways, you know, when I think about the research that I did, so many of the ideas that were developed in the laboratory of slavery and practices around health and things like that were actually then exported to the rest of the world.
Right. Think about even the speculum.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so you know, clear tie between eugenics here and then how it plays out in other parts of the world is that right that the medical technologies that were developed in the name of those things are then exported to kind of promote that in other places, right? So that's a lot of the Rockefeller Foundation and what I look at. And they're not the only ones who did it, but in this time period.
Yeah.
But then, do you want to think out loud about?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways, because when you think about surrogacy, it's impossible not to think about slavery. It's interesting because. Very often, those who are engaged in surrogacy, there's a huge debate about what exactly is being exchanged. You're paying money. Are you paying money for what?
Right.
And so people have deep anxiety about saying that you're actually paying money for
a human being. Yeah.
Yeah, because that then becomes very morally horrifying for them to engage in. So very often they say what they're really paying money for is reproductive services, right? So it's not the baby, but this embryo already belongs to me. And ownership is sort of an interesting thing that needs to be parsed out more here, right? My child, my embryo. Not my slave. I mean, there's something
interesting. The original hierarchical relationship is between parent and child.
Yes, right? And so they're like, it's my embryo that is implanted in this womb. She only provides the services. So that child is already mine. So I'm only paying her for the services. So that's one way by which people in the industry try to extricate themselves from what exactly is being bought and sold. Right?
Right.
It was also very hard for me to, at some level, talk about slavery, because when I was doing the interviews, very often these really lovely, well-meaning, intended parents, clients would tell me, "We're so glad you're writing this book, because when my child comes of a certain age, we're going to read it because it's their history of how they come." So it became this really difficult way of, like, I couldn't imagine a 13, 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 17-year-old picking up this book and saying, wow, this, you know.
Here's my origin.
So, it's thickly descriptive in particular ways without invoking certain terms. And I'm hoping readers can make that connection. I'm also at some level not calling it slavery as well, I guess, because it's not, right?
Right. I mean, because that would demean what slavery was also, right? Yeah. So it's complicated. But the other thing I was thinking about in relation to all this is just the way that there are these dominant naturalized notions of birth and and motherhood and parenting that also, you know, when we think about technology now and that map that you drew out in the beginning of the eggs coming from South Africa, the sperm coming from here, the baby being, you know, rent a womb over here, and then like this over, you know, then you're just like, this is crazy. How did we get to this point? You know, but then when you think back to slavery, right, you remember that it was never actually like everyone was having babies in this one way, or that it wasn't already parceled out in these other ways that were shot through by power and political economy and all this other stuff. And so for me, in some ways, thinking about slavery, there is the whole moral question, which I think is real and live, and I'd be interested to know what people think about that. I understand why it would be hard to talk about it in the context of building relationships with people in an ethnographic project, but I also think there's something about capitalism and reproductive labor, actually, right, and family formation and the way that the family figures in capitalism that also is a that can be thought about across time.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, at some level, you know, I don't want to say that I'm anti-surrogacy because I think my critique is really thinking about the kinds of relationships that emerge when you're buying and selling. And again, not saying then therefore you can't buy and sell, but let's think through critically, right? Because right now we're thinking about reproductive services, but also caring for children, being a nanny, is also a particular kind of reproductive service, right? So how do we say that this is not okay, but this is? And I just want to be a little bit more critical as a sociologist to think through these processes. And I'm not saying being a nanny is the same as being a surrogate mother. The kind of labor matters, there's materiality that's involved here.
Right.
But the kinds of processes, right? I mean, think about a nanny. I want her to love my child, but not so much that I get replaced, right?
Well, that's what was so interesting about the comparison between garment work and surrogacy, which is that when they were talking about garment work, they were like, I get sexually harassed on the job, I have to go home and cook. And so the kind of wide range of reproductive labor and sex, right?
And also when I teach my or talk about my book, I don't want my undergraduates to say, oh, those horrible intended parents, while, you know, you're wearing sweatshop clothes, right? I mean,
part of the same, you know,
it's these Fordist labor practices that lead to these kinds of post-Fordist kinds of neoliberal arrangements. I mean, you know.
And also it's just reproduction, you know, understood much more broadly outside of just biology as social reproduction, reproduction of society, of social relationships. And so to reduce it just to biological reproduction is actually to miss to miss what reproduction really is, right? Which is a much larger, a much larger phenomenon. I don't know if, I mean, the other thing that I want to bring out, and then I, you guys can ask each other questions and open it up, it's just a comment, which is that we've already brought it out, but this relationship between public health, medicine, capitalist imperialism, and South Asia and the United States, and, you know, when you think even of during the Cold War, the mass transfer of medical labor from South Asia to the United States, all I think is something that this work as a group brings together in a way that, you know, is worthy of consideration for those of you who haven't thought about it before, because it's actually quite, and now the history is being drawn out more, and the centrality of women, childbirth, and sort of images of Indian femininity is actually also a thread that runs throughout that at least, you know, century-long, right, history, which even before that. So those are some of the things. I don't know if you have questions for each other or if you want to...
I'm wondering if we can just...
Yeah, but that's what I was thinking. I mean, I have... Yeah. Because we can ask them.
Do people have questions?
And I let you do calling on
people. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you were talking about the garment cycle. It's first and foremost, you know, the reason why the so-called gestational carriers were being picked in India was, or Thailand, for example, exactly the same reasons why the garment manufacturing moved from China to India to Bangladesh to Vietnam was the pricing. So again, here, it is cost factor.
Yeah.
So when, you know, America is much more expensive, then you move it to India. If India becomes expensive, you move it to Thailand. If Thailand's more expensive, you move it to
India. It was in Cambodia, and now it's in Laos.
Right. Yeah. So it's, you know, the whole thing is exactly like any factory system. And the second thing is that, you know, It's like almost like a Ford, you know, the Ford T car, you know, the T car kind of a thing. You split up everything and you break it into.
That's why I call it reproductive assembly line.
Yeah, it's exactly an assembly line.
Yeah.
And I don't know, this is just a thought that maybe 20, 30 years from now, if we can actually, if some scientists come up with an artificial womb, then instead of, you know, using a gestational carrier, we just have an artificial womb. So,
yeah.
And also, would this be, the way I look at it also is in the future, I don't know, maybe 10 years, 20 years, when women who are like career women say, you know what, I don't want to carry a baby for 9 months, I'll just have a gestational carrier, I'll use my eggs, my husband's sperm. Sorry.
It's already being done, but yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just thinking that, you know, it's going, you know, it can go in so many different ways, and the whole separation of motherhood from, you know, a very deliberate separation of, you know.
Yeah, market-mediated. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's been interesting. I'm going to answer it in a slightly different way because there's right now all kinds of experimentation going on with uterine transplantations. Mm-hmm. And this is in Sweden, actually, women have given birth successfully because they do live transplantation of uteri from a live woman to another live woman. In the U.S., they're starting to do uterine transplantations as well, but also they use cadavers, even though they haven't really died. When you're doing organ harvesting, the person isn't dead, brain dead, but there's really a lot of debate about what. A fantastic book to read is Leslie Sharpe's Strange Harvest, which is a brilliant book on organ harvesting. But anyway, in the U.S., they use cadavers, and they haven't had successful pregnancies, but in Sweden they have, right? So you pump up the woman with enough hormones that the organ isn't rejected, and she's pregnant, and then she delivers the baby and the uterus both come out together. And I was actually being... A doctor had reached out to me saying, would you like to do this work? And I was like... No, but I don't think I want to look at uterine transplantation without thinking about the so-called Mississippi appendectomy,
right,
where the highest rates of, what do you call that? Removing uteri. How can I forget
Hysterectomy.
Hysterectomy. Yes. Black women have the highest rates of hysterectomies, and yet at the same time you have this uterine transplantation going on. So there's this... Yeah. So I'm like, I don't want to do that.
Because it's really interesting thinking about separating out all of these processes so that, but then the uterine transplant is all about, it's like really about this experience of pregnancy, right? So there's just, it's like such a different kind
and
of valence.
People are also at some level saying, oh, but they're not really being exploitative. Isn't it lovely that they get to experience this and no surrogate mother? And you're still like, where did that uterus come from?
I don't know.
In Germany, actually, it's also been successful. It's been a mother who donated her uterus to her daughter. So you're like, oh my God, you know, the organ out of which this person has emerged is now going to be put in her body to then leave. It's like, oi.
And part of me is like, maybe
this.
We just need to get our mind. I don't know. Like,
there's such an obsession about babies. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love my children, but there's something really perverse. There's something really, people start doing really perverse and ugly politics around the question of children. Yeah. I mean, love is just a horrible thing to organize politics around, especially love for children, right? I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but then so much ugliness emerges.
Hi. So I actually kind of have two questions that I wanted to ask you guys. When I first, I'm going to start off with kind of the easier one and then the loaded question. when I first came into like looking for things to go to and kind of better understand, because right now I'm doing some work in it. And I saw Mother India. I was really like attracted to it. I was really taken aback by it, and I was really interested because I was like, okay, there's something out there about all that's going on between India and America and the kind of cultural conflicts that happen between it. And I was very interested in like the crossing borders that you talk about and the imperialism that you talk about. And kind of what you touched upon and what I really appreciated was how public health is a factor. And I just wanted to ask you, how is public health or social sciences or whatever you want to connect to either helped or hurt mothers and daughters of India and more broadly South Asia? How do you think?
So the history of public health, I mean, even though it sounds like a public good, is much like population control or public development is a method of actually entering into populations and managing them in lots of ways. It doesn't mean that certain kinds of antibiotics or whatever don't get distributed through it, but it was initially engineered by the Rockefeller Foundation and in some ways medical missionaries were the original, and one of the reasons why they went towards medicine was because, and especially missionaries from the United States, is because they were having trouble converting people through kind of the traditional, you know, read the Bible and someone will be converted ways. And so to enter into, and this is also why they chose childbirth, is to enter into bodily functions and to do this kind of save the body and then you'll save the soul type
thing.
Enter
into the family as well.
And enter into the family, and then it gave women a way to enter into the family because only women, in a place like India where the women are supposedly locked away, only women could enter into that. And so it became a justification for sort of engaging with populations in the most intimate and direct ways, but through a way that you could also manage and control them and that you could justify, right? And so public health in the U.S. started after Reconstruction in the U.S. South, right, going in to poor white as well as formerly enslaved black communities and kind of coming up with different public health models, which were then exported around the world. So they were exported to British colonies where U.S. capitalists, like the Rockefellers, wanted to intervene. And so that, in some ways, is the history of public health. It's actually not the history of doing good, even though it has this moral imperative that comes from Christianity.
And
right?
At some level, you could say the unintended effect of this is good happens, sure.
Yes, but that's not the political, economic, or even moral context for it, right? Because even Rockefeller himself was a Baptist and really into the, and it's very much part of the civilizing mission of capitalist imperialism. So if Christianity was the original civilizing mission, public health in some ways became the next one for the United States in particular. And so that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the next step. And so in some ways that is how, and then public health has become a vector through which capitalist imperialism and various different kinds of ideological and political projects spread.
For sure. Thank you.
Yeah.
If you had a
so these are the more loaded one.
I want to hear that loaded one.
If anyone else wants to ask, and I can ask that one. Take up everyone's time.
No. You should. You have your. You have.
I'm sorry already. How have South Asian women been influenced by the deeper issues of imperialism and eugenics, and really recently model minority issues, especially when involving cultural value conflicts caused by differing cultures, America, the UK, and Asia? Why do you think women have been the guinea pigs of these different movements more so, and why do you really think that this is the case so much more in India and South Asian communities? Any of that makes sense?
Some of it did. I'll say the first thing, I don't think it's necessarily been more the case in India or South Asian communities.
Okay.
I mean, I think that women have been, you know, for many communities have been sort of the site of,
just say, because it's kind of my focus right now, I think that's why my mind went there, but I agree.
Right, which is just to sort of reiterate that when this project is looking at the U.S. and India and kind of trying to thread it through public health and public health, which then is not the same as development, but in some ways is continuous with development. So to think about these technologies of U.S. imperialism that get kind of deployed in developmental projects in India specifically, but as I say, I think that you could find a version of something that looks like eugenic feminism in other national sites. Like, I don't think that there's something
specific.
There are specificities about it,
yes,
but it's not specific to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
you were talking about, you know, it does good accidentally or whatever of this mm-hmm. whole thing. And one of the things she said is about women in South Asia. I was reading about women in Puerto Rico. There mm-hmm. was a whole
mass sterilization.
Right, right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
yeah. At a certain point of time.
Yeah.
So from what my perception is, that doing good is the face of it. It's like advertising. Mm-hmm. You say, hey, right. you can have fun if you drink Coke mm-hmm. and if you buy Coke. Mm-hmm. But your goal is not... Really,
the doing
the
good.
Goal of Coke is not for you to have fun. Their goal is to make money.
Yeah.
And so what they're telling you is you're going to have fun when yeah. you drink Coke. But their own agenda is yeah. how much profit do we make? So yeah. even in this particular scenario, yeah. I don't think the goal was to do good. The yeah. goal was to let you think that it is
yes.
good for
yes.
you.
Exactly.
Yeah. But their own agenda right. would be, you yeah. know.
No, I say there's unintentionally, you know, good happens is like, for example, you know, thinking about the women that I was working with, right? Sterilization, they were choosing sterilization as a form of birth control. Is that a good? Well, if there's no other form of birth control available, right? Sure. I mean, they don't want to be having more than one or two children. They simply don't. Now, I mean, it's an unintentional good, but the question is, why aren't there other forms?
Or what are the other?
Right, yeah, what and why?
Or for example, yeah. I was doing all this research on like tropical medicine and public health mm-hmm. and how it was part of imperialism, and then I went somewhere tropical and got these bug bites, and they were like not going away mm-hmm. and spreading all over me, and I was like about to go to the Harvard Tropical Medical Center to see if they could like cure me. That's in a way like
so that's what I mean.
That's what yeah. we mean. Yeah. You know, like yeah. in a way, like no one else was going to be able to give me like whatever yes. I needed to get over the friggin' yeah. like. Although it turned out they didn't know either, and I had to go meditate. Right, so like it ended up. I went into 10-day silent meditation, and the bug bites went away. That's a whole other story. But yeah. so in a way, the medical complex didn't actually help me. But I think yeah. like in a landscape where we actually don't have access or haven't developed other ways to yeah. distribute, because I think part of what it is that medical research is not all, like some of it is actually. Like, I'm alive. I was in a car accident where I almost died. I'm alive today because somebody was able to stitch me back together, right?
Yeah.
So that is, the technology in itself right. is not necessarily all bad. It's the way it's deployed and in what name and the way it's distributed and, yeah. and yeah. all that kind of thing that I think yeah. is yeah. more what we're talking about. But that is a conversation more than a conclusion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think the medical industrial complex is I think that's the perfect word to
yeah.
use.
Yeah.
Because, again, you know, if your goal is, like I said, you know, if you call it whatever world domination or whatever it is mm-hmm. you want to call, mm-hmm. then that is just another weapon or a strategy in furthering your agenda. That's
yeah, yeah.
one
yeah.
of the mm-hmm. strategies.
Yes.
I mean, there are many other strategies, but it seems yes. like, you know, that is, like you said, the most intimate, because I was reading an article where literally they're building hospitals in India, the missionaries, and the first time they let you come in, the second time they let you come in, the third time they say, oh, unless you convert, we will not be able mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. get treatment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Same with schools. Mm-hmm. Okay, sorry, we can't give you mm-hmm. admission into our school unless mm-hmm. and until you convert. Mm-hmm. Or we cannot give you a job unless and until you convert. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you go build the hospitals, etc. But again, your agenda is very clear. It mm-hmm. is to convert, but, you know, like I said, the front of it is like, oh, this is so good for you. But I've read, mm-hmm. you know, articles, they will not give you medicine, they will not let mm-hmm. you go to the hospital, won't give you admission unless you convert.
Yeah, I think the other thing to think about in conversion is that there is a conversion to medicine being part of development.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that in order for the country to develop, we need to have, and that's part of what led to the brain drain and things like that too. So it's not just Christian conversion, it's also mm-hmm. conversion to medical capitalism in a lot of different mm-hmm. ways, that, and modernity being
yeah.
linked to that, right?
Yeah, again, the whole...
Yeah, I'm sorry, she had her hand up, so we haven't heard from her yet. Hi.
Hi, thank you for this amazing talk, it was really interesting. I had two kind of questions. One was, as I was listening to you, I was really connecting a lot of what you were saying around eugenics and sexual health and public health, eugenics, feminism, to HIV funding and HIV movement that is happening, and I'm wondering if you can talk about that. And my second kind of thought and question was, when you were talking about medicine and access to medicine and specifically Gandhi's kind of thoughts around medicine, and I was thinking about ideas around purity and pollution and caste mm-hmm. and how medicine as a tool of communities yeah. was inaccessible to public communities.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And yes. also like Mother Teresa's aversion to giving mm-hmm. medicine to people. Yeah. But I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
Gosh.
It's a lot of stuff. No, that's great. I have to say, I can't say too much about the HIV. I just don't know that much about that. But I would say on the question of purity, and you know, part of me wants to go back to Catherine Mayo, bizarrely, right? Because so much of what she's doing with kind of refiguring Mother India as this kind of like abject low caste, explicitly, because sort of in that chapter when she's talking about both the midwife, right, the dai, and the mother, and it's sort of the subject of Mother India splits, and it's unclear actually in that chapter what the sort of status of the, but it's presumably a higher status woman who's giving birth, and it's this lower stat, you know, lower caste woman who's attending to her. And so I don't know if that's really answering your question, but I'm just sort of thinking about how, I don't know if that's getting to your question. Your question is how ideas of purity. I mean, I would say that it's precisely against that kind of pollution, right? That any kind of eugenic formulation is being mounted. And so part of actually what I'm trying to do, and this is taking it sort of from that specific thinking about caste and purity and pollution and things like that, and just thinking about purity in a larger sense. If eugenics is all about this kind of, in some ways, a utopian narrative of purity, part of what I'm trying to say with eugenic feminism is like we need to get away from those kinds of progress narratives and sort of to say, to talk about it, I am talking about a very specific strand of feminism and a very specific both history and kind of this rhetorical and political move to a progress narrative about purity and about political purity, and saying, no, like, we just need to get rid of the idea of purity because that's eugenic, basically, right? So there's the actual eugenics, and then I'm trying to make a larger kind of...
But can I kind of intervene in terms of how it works with surrogacy? Yes. And I was thinking about one of the client parents that I interviewed, a Jewish couple, and she thought, like, her baby was... Well, all parents think that... Well, I'm being
not
a bit mean. I'm being a bit mean. But she, you know, she was so happy with the whole process of surrogacy because she'd said, I have a Mohinju baby, right? What did she mean by that? Her surrogate mother was a Muslim, the egg donor was a Hindu, and the sperm, her husband, is Jewish. So the baby literally was like this Mohinju baby. Isn't that amazing? That look what surrogacy allows us to do. It makes the world come together, right? Like Coke does, right? But it's this amazing,
it actually is like
you know. It's like, you know, it meant a lot to her. So there's these questions of purity that are actually at some level become these consumerist, global sort of, what shall I say, a cosmopolitan notion that surrogacy then starts going down. It's all people saying, look, we're not racist, right? Because we have these beautiful babies who are multiracial.
We are the world.
Right.
I mean, a lot of my work has to do with caste and the way that I worked on nursing and the history of nursing, right, which is all about ritual pollution and purity and the translation of that into the Indian context and the way that, or, you know, in a Hindu dominant context, really, right, and the way that that got translated as being a particularly South Asian problem, this kind of, you know, tension around purity and pollution. But I think one of the things that I try to think about is how caste hierarchies are compounded through colonial structures around race and class and caste, and how, you know, the hospital system in India and also the medical care system then takes and remakes caste under colonialism and under the developmental state. And so it's not medicine itself, but it's the way in which it's organized. It actually compounds these hierarchies that are in motion, right? So not to understand them as static, but I think it's hard to, I mean, the other thing, the question I had for you, because you didn't actually, I don't know, are there client parents who are from India who get surrogacy, and how does caste play out in those contexts? Because the question of birth and, you know, what caste is the woman who's carrying my baby would seem to be, because then there are also these, you know, I asked about slavery because I'm from the United States, but when you think about India, there are these relationships of servant and, you know, and how a servant does certain kinds of care work and how caste plays out. So I was wondering if it played out in surrogacy.
Yeah, I mean, most of the surrogate mothers I interviewed were from dominant castes, right? But that doesn't mean it doesn't play out in other ways. Mm-hmm. I'd done a bunch of participant observation in Sulu's clinic, Sulu Chinnagunashila's clinic, where they were also doing, you know, embryo donation among clients, you know, so on and so forth. And she tells me how this client came to her and said, I would really like a Hindu embryo. Yeah. And the doctor was incensed. She was like, embryos don't have religion. But, you know, but I will give you a viable embryo and you can raise it Hindu or whatever you once it's born, but embryos really don't have religion. So, you know, so they, you know, so there would be those sorts of requests made.
I imagine,
I've heard of cases where Indians would want, you know, certain kinds of caste women to be their surrogate mothers. But it's also interesting to think about questions of race in a different way in terms of surrogacy, right? I'm thinking about Horton Spiller's article, Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe. Whereas with surrogacy, it's Papa's babies, Mama's never, right? In this sense, right? Because, and the race of the baby is actually determined by
the egg and sperm.
Not just the egg and sperm, even if they've used an Indian egg, it's just in terms of the social life of the child.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, because race isn't even genetic.
Yes, it's not genetic, right? So this is precisely why I would say it's, you know, it's not mama's babies, papa's maybe. It's papa's baby, mama's actually never, really. Mama doesn't matter, right? So race then, at some level, becomes of that child in the household it's being raised. It's actually at some level that genetic thing is just ephemera. It's just, it just disappears.
I don't know if any of us had the answer around HIV though. Sorry about that.
It's
but it's definitely part of the picture, and it would be a super interesting thing to think more about or know more about.
Just a question in regards to population in South Asia since independence, how it has exploded. Was there any in your research that you guys did you find a common reason or a cause or what happened in the last 70 plus years that the population has quadrupled? Was there anything that indicated what was going on in the country? I know it was independent. I'm not just talking about India, but the whole South Asian subcontinent. What was the reason? Was there any indication?
I'm going to be quite the Marxist and say it's redistribution.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the poor have children not because, you know, because infant mortality is much higher for Dalits, for the poor. And so if you want to optimize the number of live children you're going to have more children because, you know, after, you know.
Not
all of them survive. So that can lead to more and more people having children. Also, it's been interesting because the southern Indian states actually have replacement growth, population growth, right? It's because of these ways by which they've been very effective with distributing
maternal.
Yeah, maternal and child, you know. So it's just, I think Kerala, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu and Andhra. It's, you know, I think at Karnataka it's 2.1. So it's really the other states that, some of the other states that have caused.
So literacy had something to do with it as well?
Sure, but one would imagine that you would also need just solid jobs and an ability to feed your children in some safety net, right? Which would be the best way to deal with population. But actually it's been interesting thinking about your, both of your works as well, is a new project I want to do actually takes me back in time to 1876-78, because in Madras Presidency and under the Mysore Princely State, there's a famine in that time that I read about in, you know, Mike Davis's late Victorian Holocaust, right? But that famine leaves 5.5 million people dead in 2 years. That's 20 to 25% of the population is dead, right? And this is literally people dying on the streets, right? It's so visceral. But yet there is no popular memory of this, right? And I feel that so much of the anxiety around managing land scientifically and managing population scientifically emerges from these kinds of concerns regarding famine. And so the next project is really thinking about, you know, the Kaveri River, when the KRS dam is built, you know, and the three government-sponsored population, no, family planning clinics are opened in Mysore, Bangalore, Mandya, right, to, that's 1930. KRS, rural Mysore, has electricity before, for example, Texas does, rural Texas does, right? It's this great modernizing scientific movement. To the 1960s, when you have population control, but you also have the Green Revolution that's emerging, right? To the contemporary moment that's sort of thinking through farmers committing suicide and surrogate mothers being recruited. So I think it's really about redistribution, but these long histories of land and body management.
The reason I was asking was because, you know, I have heard that in India, sex determination. So I don't know if that played into it, because obviously everyone wants to have a male child. And if you have less females being born, does that play into it?
Yeah, right now sex determination is banned in India, and the way they went about it is doctors are not allowed to reveal the sex of the fetus because then, you know, women might have abortions. And earlier it was suggested that you actually then have, you know, legal action against the women, but you don't know why the woman. Is it the husband? Is it the mother-in-law who's forcing her to, right? So you go, you don't allow doctors to reveal the sex of the fetus. That doesn't mean it's actually changed. I mean, it has had some impact on sex ratios of infants, but not that much. There's still sex selection going on.
Other questions?
You mentioned the famine of Madras and whatever. Was it similar to the Bengal famine, where they were growing cotton for the factories and therefore there was a famine?
I think the Bengal, I mean, gets studied so much. I think it's really interesting to think about the South Indian famine. They're certainly exporting food from other parts of India to England. And there's also actually talk about this is, you know, survival of the fittest. We need to let these people die off. So it's really good population management that, you know, the British, the Governor General at the time is making these sorts of arguments. But they're also hoping that the market will take care of it, that if there's this many people, then, you know, it creates for growing crops, so on and so forth. But I think really the famine sets some massive changes that go on that really haven't been studied, I feel. And I'm wondering about also missionaries coming in. You know,
they did actually, I read about that. It was after that famine that a lot of missionaries came in and were able to. Because there were a lot of orphans. And so they were able to kind of recruit in that way. I don't remember where I read it, but I'll look for it.
I think that famine has had such an afterlife, but it would be really interesting to think through it. And I don't know whether
we have like 5 minutes, so maybe you can talk, both of you, about your a little bit about what your next, because I mentioned in the beginning what your next projects are going to be, so maybe you guys can both say a little bit about that.
Okay, well, I'm writing my book backwards. So right now I have a title, which is From Opium to Outsourcing. And really what I'm trying to think about is, and so it's kind of a global South Asian diaspora project. And so trying to think about kind of South Asian labor, the need for South Asian labor. So thinking about 19th century diasporas to the Caribbean and to Africa, and sort of thinking about what is sort of the role that South Asian labor plays, sort of these different moments. And then thinking, of course, about the post kind of 65 moment, well, post kind of World War II moments of immigration to the UK and then also to North America. And so thinking about these different diasporas. And as a literary scholar, there's a whole literary archive that I will be doing this through, which I'm still kind of figuring out. But that's the larger trajectory of the project, which I'm not so sure about. But what I've actually been working on really is more of the outsourcing piece. So again, this book that ends with surrogacy and sort of thinking about outsourcing. And then I've also been, it's not really part of the book, but I wrote a piece about outsourcing and terror and thinking about how these are the two predominant ways that people think about South Asia, South Asians and South Asia in the United States, right? So these are the kinds of just associations and what are the links between them, and part of it is through development, you know, both through the creation of through technical institutes and things like this, post-independence, that actually created a lot of infrastructure for outsourcing, and there's also the ways that the government supports outsourcing that also has supported the brain drain. So thinking about those kind of things together. And I'm also looking, so then part of that, thinking about outsourcing, and a lot of it's sort of thinking about it within the U.S. imaginary, is I'm looking at, I don't know if anyone remembers the TV series Outsourced from 2010. Yeah, so I'm yeah,
it's
the three of us. Okay, yeah. There you go. So I'm thinking about that, and just like also because that's such an interesting. I just think there's something really interesting about that moment because 2010 is not now, and even though there's ways in which that show was kind of offensive, like I still there's something about like there are many ways, but there's still something about it that feels like this different moment. Like it feels like a very kind of like pre-Trump moment, bizarrely, even though you could make outsourcing could be funny, right, instead of sort of being just completely this threat or something. So that's kind of like the project. The second project is mostly I'm just thinking about outsourcing right now, and it might just turn into a project on outsourcing. But we'll see. I have this title that I want to figure out how to
opium.
Make work. Yeah, opium. There's...
The famine. I'm certainly interested in the famine. I think also I started getting interested in it and sort of thinking about bioeconomies because people tend to study agriculture and ag tech stuff or they study human bodies. But really, I think these kinds of technologies and bioeconomies emerge, you know, in these parallel ways. And I think that famine helps me think through that. But also that famine project is leading to all kinds of interesting sorts of developments and spin-offs. For example, the Criminal Tribe Act in India, right? I think in the northern India, it's 1871. In the Tamil Nadu region and Bangalore, you know, Mysore presidency, Mysore princely state, it's enacted in 1880, 2 years after the famine. And I have a feeling that there's hunger is starting to get racialized or caste and caste ways, but also there's a criminalization of hunger that's going on that I would like to think through that a little bit more by the Criminal Tribe Act. So it's just leading me in these all these strange ways, but the fun project is going to be global markets and human hair. So I'm going to go to Tirupati and get my hair shaved.
Tirupati is a big temple in South India, yeah, which is next to the Vatican, the most... The richest, wealthiest religious person.
So they produce 500 tons of hair, and women, men, going and sacrificing the hair to God.
To God.
It's a divine gift.
I did
that
it.
Becomes trash. Right? And then from becoming trash, it becomes a global commodity. To it becomes wigs or extensions for black women, but also for Orthodox Jewish women, it's the wig. So that's the fun project.
Hair is complicated, actually.
Hair starts becoming, it's going,
So, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.